The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Congress has now passed an $8 billion emergency coronavirus funding bill to help battle the spread, sending that bill straight to the president's desk.
Thousands of passengers on that cruise ship are stuck at sea off the coast of California right now, confined to their rooms as they wait for test results.
And right here in New York, thousands of people are self-quarantining at home after they may have come in contact with the coronavirus. A 12th fatality has now been reported here in the United States, the latest in Washington state. And at this hour, the number of cases topping 200.
And it was certainly a super Tuesday for Joe Biden. No question about that. He rode a fast-breaking wave to score a primary comeback beyond any that has come before. The former vice president swept the South, surprised in the North, put himself back on top of this race.
Let's get to the elephant in the room. 126 on a US 30-year. What are we modeling in the Treasury market right now?
We're modeling two things, a massive global economic slowdown. And the second thing we're modeling is that the Fed, whether it should or should not, will cut rates. John, I look at another spread, and it's an important one. It's the difference between US and Germany. Do you remember the days when that was at 280 basis points?
Yep.
240 basis points, we're below 150. And what that's telling you is that the bond market is also worried that the U.S. outperformance relative to Europe in particular is not going to be as great. So this is not just a generalized slowdown. This is one in which the U.S. also, unfortunately, is going to get dragged down more towards Europe. So be careful out there.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Another volatile week for the financial markets, the stock market beginning to resemble the roller coaster ride at Magic Mountain. And the impact of the coronavirus continues to weigh on the markets. Friday's surprise strong job numbers failed to arrest fears. The virus impact on the economy as more cases are reported, with now 11 confirmed deaths in the U.S. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me today is John Roque from Wolfe Research. According to John, this correction has a ways to go. He's looking for the tech sector to finally break down before maybe we reach a bottom. John strongly favors gold and defensive stocks. And also later on in the program, Danielle DiMartino Booth will join us. She says the service sector will probably be the hardest hit when it comes to the U.S. economy, because the U.S. is mainly a service economy today. There's also the issues of record corporate debt, which may explain the emergency Fed rate cut of a half a point this week, as 10-year bond yields intraday on Friday got down to nearly 0.6%. Absolutely amazing. A couple of years ago, I had Gary Schilling on the program, a time when the 10-year yield was at 3%. Well, he said it was going to 1%. Well, we're below that now. And later on in the program, Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's hear from Ryan Poplava as to the stories driving this week's markets.
Thanks, Jim. Let's talk about the catalysts that moved the market this week. This week was about expectations for stimulus after a major crushing to the Chinese ISM figures on Monday, the emergency action by the Fed on Tuesday to cut rates 50 basis points, and then the rebound in the market after Biden showed promising election results after Super Tuesdays. But concerns about the economic impact of the spread of the coronavirus and fear that we haven't even begun to see the full effect on the U.S. has choked off any kind of buying interest, and it continues to funnel money into the safety trade of treasuries and gold. So let's talk about that specifically. Gold retested its highs on Friday when it hit 1690 in the futures market, and treasuries weren't really testing anything other than how low rates can dance the limbo, and that bar seems to be getting lower by the day. Treasuries have been one of the biggest communicators in this whole mess. On days the market rallied, like on Monday in anticipation of more stimulus, and on Wednesday post the election results, the 10-year treasury yield yet continued to decline. Without a rally in yields and a sell-off from bonds, it left very little faith in any kind of long-term bottom here this week. So the Fed cut interest rates around 50 basis points on Tuesday. This was the first such emergency move by the Fed since December of 2008 during the financial crisis. While the Fed can't address the demand risks the coronavirus represents on the economy, it basically cut rates in hopes to stabilize the financial markets, which have been in turmoil now for weeks. The rally in stocks on Tuesday on the Fed's cuts seemed to leave something wanting, given the Treasury market didn't bottom, but probably because the federal fund futures were still pricing in another 50 basis point cut at the FOMC meeting in 2 weeks. Now, that led to a negative close for the stocks despite that accommodative move by the Fed. And you know, that's really worries that the coronavirus will adversely affect earnings continue to increase as three states have declared emergencies, schools are closing down, and companies are telling employees to work from home. The economic fallout from the virus hasn't been felt more than in the travel industry and really represents the core destruction in what we're seeing. The 9/11-like experience of empty flights and quiet airports is showing the real destruction felt and is estimated by the International Air Transport Association to hurt airline revenues by $63 to $113 billion. That didn't faze Warren Buffett. As news spread this week, he bought more shares of Delta Airlines. Finally, elections on Tuesday showed that Biden took the lead, but it's still a close race between him and Bernie Sanders. A more moderate Democrat in the lead left stock market more helpful. But again, no bottom in the Treasury market. The Treasury market itself is approaching a parabolic move and is the next spot I'm watching for an opportunity. In a little over 2 months, the 10-year Treasury has fallen from 1.91% to 0.7% and change. This next FOMC meeting is shaping up to be a very important one for Treasuries and the trajectory of rates. Can Powell thread the needle with Fed policy like his predecessors before him? And that's the question. It's going to stay an interesting couple of weeks ahead, so watch rates for the message they're transmitting. And that's it for this week's wrap-up report. Andrew Zatlin of South Bay Research told our listeners this week that he thinks that the U.S. is not going to be hit nearly as hard as we've seen in China or the rest of the world, and that most of the damage is going to be abroad. In the short term, there will be a hit to growth. However, in the long term, one of the main messages that he is communicating to others is the fact that this is going to, as we've been discussing on our show over the past couple weeks, that the coronavirus shock to global supply chains is going to accelerate the trend of reshoring both to America and to other countries outside of China, as this issue has made starkly clear that too many countries, too many companies are too overly exposed to China as a manufacturing center, and that there needs to be a diversification of supply chains to other countries.
I think we're actually going to see a huge upsurge in onshoring of jobs. And in fact, that's going to be good for the GDP. Now, it takes a while for this to play out. Right now, there's a lot of information out there, misinformation, incomplete information. But I think it's safe to say that regardless of how deadly or not this is, it's everybody's reaction to it that matters. And the reaction right now is, I am not willing to put myself, my family, my loved ones in harm's way. So I'm not going to do a lot of things. I think that's actually, again, a huge boon for the U.S. economy. What happens in April, usually spring break, a lot of people go to Mexico. A lot of spending goes outside of the U.S. Well, guess what? This year, people will spend it inside the U.S. So I actually think that the response to this isn't, I'm not going to spend. It's, where am I going to spend? And a lot of that is going to end up being in the U.S. for the U.S. market. So I think you actually have a counterwave developing.
To listen to this full interview with Andrew Zatlin, in addition to our three interviews we conduct every week with book authors, investment strategists, and economic forecasters, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
The stock market continues to go through convulsions, up 1,000 points one day, down 1,000 points the next. How will this end? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is John Roque. And John, let's get right into it. I mean, volatility is unlike anything I've seen in quite some time. Let's begin with the top. What are you seeing here?
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me back on the show. We think it's quite likely that the S&P comes back down again after the sharp rally off of last Friday's low. As you mentioned, the volatility is extreme. We think it's very hard to get the mix right in terms of stocks and or sectors. And with the market behaving as such, really long-only managers are playing for relative outperformance. And on a day-to-day basis, it's seemingly changing. So we think it's probably likely that we come in, get back down toward last week's lows, if not break them. And a good low probably won't form until the last bastion of strength is really weakened. And that's the technology sector.
So we've seen a lot of these sectors, from energy to financial to industrials. And John, how long, you know, I've seen that because of the supply side disruptions, we could see weaker economic growth in the first and second quarter. And a lot of people don't see this thing playing out until by the time we get to summer. And we just got this emergency cut from the Fed, and they're predicting that more rate cuts are on the horizon. But I don't know how much rate cuts are really going to help the supply chain.
Yeah, I'm gonna answer your question in the following fashion. I definitely don't know how much the rate cuts will help the supply chain or not help it at all. What I am concerned with is the fact that, so you had 2 days, the day of the Fed rate cut, the next day where we had a sharp rally, and then again, we're selling off here. We've had two sharp days where the market did not use that good news from the Fed to push higher substantially or to solidify itself or stabilize. And I think the inability to respond well to what has historically been good news is a concerning sign. It likely says that this corrective phase, whatever you want to call it, is not yet done.
Yeah, because in the past, we've seen things, whether it was trade wars, tariffs, the market maybe sells off for a couple of days and responds back. It was by the dip. So the market was ignoring any kind of bad news, but it doesn't seem to be the case now. Anytime there's more news on the virus or anything like that, there seems to be a sharp reaction on the negative side.
Yeah, and it seems that either the market or the Fed wants us collectively to make a decision about the virus. And I'm not going to even mention it any more than that, because there's no way any of us can.
Yeah. I mean, how do you predict where it's going to erupt or what it's going to happen or when it's going to run its course? So when you see this kind of volatility where we're up one day, 1,000 points, down 1,200 points, what do you do from a technical point of view if you're an investor? If you own a high quality stock, do you dump it? If you see something beaten up pretty bad, do you buy it? Or you just sit on the sidelines and wait for this thing to play out?
Well, I think if you're an active investor, you have to be aware that there's some risk here. The S&P has been up. I know that we had a 2011 sharp down move, and we had it again in 18. But really, the S&P has been in an uptrend since 2009, off of its lows in 2009. And we really haven't suffered very much for very long since that time. So to expect that we could go through a period where stocks don't make much headway or any headway at all is not that crazy. I think if you put that in context to historical periods where we've had big rallies, and then you go through some corrective phase, it doesn't seem that extraordinary.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you take a look at what was the low in 2009, was it 666?
And that's correct.
And we got up to what, 3,400, 3,300. I mean, that's a hell of a move.
Right, that is a hell of a move. And it wouldn't surprise me if we had some further activity on the downside, if only because, and we'll forget the tremendous overarching statements that any of us can make, but even just to get to a weekly oversold reading on some momentum indicators is going to take a little time. So that's what we think is likely to happen.
So when you look at some of the safety trade, you've got utilities, and even though technology stocks fell, they bounced back very, very quickly. So for this thing to bottom in your mind, the last strongest sector has got to break down as well?
To me, that's what normally would get us closer to making a low. The line used to be a long time ago when I was much younger in the business, you know, they come for the pretty girls last. And, you know, perhaps we could say they'll come for the strongest sector last this time, or they come for the strongest sector as you near the end of a decline, because people will hold on to those stocks almost until the end.
I want to talk about another sector that's doing very well, and that is the bond markets. If we take a look at treasuries, John, on the day you and I are doing doing this interview on a Thursday, we've got the 10-year yield down to almost 0.9%. I mean, I haven't seen anything like that. 30-year mortgages are below 3.3%. What's your take on bonds here?
Well, my take on is that almost every year in my career, people have been looking for higher yields. And every year, we've worked almost toward lower yields. And even this year, rates looked like they were going to give you a shot to the upside, but they got stuffed at a downward sloping 200-day moving average. The TLT, which is a good proxy for bond prices, did not break down. And the TLT, which is the representation of a 20-year plus maturity, acts very well. And nobody, and I said that in quotations, generally nobody would have expected yields to be this weak. So the bonds continue to look good. And I guess with the equity market this week, it's probably not a good idea to be looking to sell your bonds here, because this is probably, outside of gold, the only thing that's really working.
And speaking of gold, let's talk about that.
Well, I'm a big fan of gold, and I've been fairly consistent over the last year to say that gold will make a new all-time high in this cycle. We recently did a study of gold in 24 currencies, dollar included, and gold is at a new all-time high in 16 of those currencies. We think before this cycle is over, gold will make a new all-time high in all currencies, and consequently, we think gold is going to get above its former all-time high, which occurred in 2011. And we think that, you know, the action here suggests that this is where you want to be. You want to have some exposure to gold. Gold's high in 2011 was $1,921. And we think the continued low rates, not only here, but globally, makes it easier to own gold.
So if you were looking at gold, would you be buying the bullion as an investor, or would you be buying some of the gold stocks, which sometimes go up more than the bullion itself? How would you play this?
Well, in fact, we agree with you, Jim. Usually when there's a gold bull market, the gold stocks go up much more than gold. And I don't see that there's any reason to think otherwise in this stage. As long as the underlying commodity is strong, I think people will want to have some exposure to gold stocks. So I tend to agree with you, because that's what the history suggests.
So given this fact that we're talking about a correction, we still don't know how much lower this can go, but you expect this has further to play out. Looking at all the markets, whether you're looking at emerging markets, overseas markets, and U.S. markets, when this thing does come back, do you expect the U.S. to be the best place to be?
So we think that when there is a low made, it is quite likely that the U.S. leads again. It is quite likely that tech leads again. And given low rates, it is likely that we could surmise that growth would probably be hard to come by, and investors would want to, again, own growth stocks. That's our sort of game plan right here, that when a low does occur, the U.S. will lead. Technology stocks will lead, and low rates will continue to tell people that that growth is not going to happen very strongly, and you probably want to continue to be overweight technology stocks.
If you were looking at this to be or turn into something more than, let's say, a major correction, what kind of things would you be looking at to tell you that maybe this time it's a little different?
Well, again, I think it's going to come down to how the leading stocks or the leading sectors or indexes behave. So, for example, there's no secret that Microsoft has been a leading stock. If Microsoft cannot hold on any decline, $140, which we think is pretty darn good support. The stock was there for about 4 or 5 months throughout 2019. And when it finally broke out in late October, it went from 140 all the way up to 190 in early February. So on any decline, we expect Microsoft to hold the 140 level. But if it didn't, then whatever shortfall we're looking for here, we're likely to be a little bit surprised to the downside if Microsoft can't hold 140.
Okay, so you're very positive on gold, and you think by the time this is done, we're going to see new all-time records for gold, including in U.S. currency. Let's talk about some of the other commodities, and one that is not doing well is oil. What's your take on energy?
So on oil, we actually had a note to clients, you know, a month and a half or so ago, that we thought oil was going to go lower, and we have a $36 target for crude. And I know historically, normally when you have gold leading, it usually is a sign for other commodities to also start doing better. But we think that this time is not like some other periods in history with respect to gold leading, specifically because of lower interest rates. We think oil has further risk to the downside. And so our target, Jim, is in the mid-30s.
And do you see other commodities following similar suit? I'm thinking of copper, tin, iron ore, the industrial type commodities.
We know that, first off, we would also say if gold is leading, we would expect silver to also participate. Silver's been a little reluctant to play along here, which is a little bit concerning for us because we would have thought by now that silver would have played along. But it's basing, and there's not anything wrong with it, but we thought would have done better. And copper and other industrial metals, where we don't have strong opinions on because we think that they're going to have to go through some longer-term period of improvement. Copper really doesn't look like it's ready for us to suggest that it's going to rally strongly.
Okay, let's talk about some specific type of stocks, value stocks. You mentioned growth stocks should do well coming out of this. What about some of the yields on some of these blue chip stocks? I mean, I don't care if you're looking at energy, if you're looking at pharmaceutical stocks, if you're looking at some of the industrial stocks, you're looking at, John, at yields that are 3, 4, 5, 6 times that of a 10-year treasury note. Would you be looking at dividend yields or would you avoid that sector?
So we like the notion of dividend yields. I would just like it better if the stocks that I'm looking for with high dividend yields stop going down. Now, for example, we know that Exxon has, if the dividend is still good, and I'm not challenging it, I'm just wondering, perhaps maybe there's an issue, that Exxon pays a 7% dividend. That's a really strong dividend, but the stock has gone down over the last 2 weeks from $60 to $49. It'd be wonderful to know that I'm getting a 7% dividend, but it would be wonderful to know that if the stock were to stop going down.
That's amazing because the company came out in a press conference and said they're still planning to spend money. They see higher oil prices in this decade, and they're proceeding to try to increase what their production and cash flow is going to be. But what about some of these safety trades? I'm thinking of staples, utilities, REITs. What's your take on these three sectors?
So I'm glad you brought up the utilities. So I'm going to tell you, we sent out a note to clients this morning entitled, "It Is Different This Time." And that was a takeoff on a book written by economists Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. Their title was, "This Time Is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly." And in the book, they went through 66 financial crises, and they found that the inputs for financial crises over decades, for 66 of them, were often the same. So their title was a bit sarcastic. There was no sarcasm in my title. It is different this time. And the Dow Jones Utility Average yesterday was up 5% and up 5% for the second time in 3 days. I went back over 10,000 trading days and found that there have been only 15 other times over 10,000 trading days where the Dow Jones Utility Average had gained at least 5%. And in all of the prior 13 instances, they had occurred where both the S&P and the utility index was down a lot more than it had been down in recent days. So we want to say that the action in the utilities or the volatility in markets and indexes in general is fairly abnormal here. And it is hard to make a historical comparison because if you looked historically at the Dow Jones Utility Average prior periods when it was up 5% one day, it was in either the throes of a bear market or you were coming toward the end of a bear market. And we don't think that's the case here.
Yeah, because you look at utilities over the last couple of days, it looks like a NASA space launch.
or it trades like a technology stock.
Yeah, you could be looking at Apple here with looking at the chart.
Exactly.
What about some of these other safety trades? Let's talk about staples and let's talk about REITs.
So I think, Jim, that the REITs are in the same sort of camp as the utilities. The REITs are benefiting from low rates in bonds, and that's wonderful here. In fact, the REITs are barely up on a year-to-date basis, while the utilities are up almost 4%. I would go back to an earlier comment I made with respect to tech. I realize that utilities and REITs have been strong here, and I understand that they can continue to outperform, but we probably won't make a good market low until even these stocks and staples, which have been strong, also come under some pressure.
So given what you see right now, you don't expect that we've seen a bottom yet. This has further to play out. Sectors are doing very well. Our utilities and what we call the safety trade, you expect a new high on gold. If you were an investor sitting on the sidelines, or let's say you were sitting holding some blue chip stocks, or you're sitting on a lot of cash, what would you be doing?
Well, I would try to get some gold exposure. That's the first thing that I would be looking to do, because I think the environment continues to be a positive for gold because of the low interest rates and the fact that we think that governments will continue to, in quotes, debase their currencies. And when it comes right down to it, it's our belief that gold is actually a currency. And we think the market will still try to figure out how to trade the Fed's 50 basis points emergency cut. And we think this is a pretty good environment for gold.
Well, I agree with you. And this is, you know, when you're looking at where's a safe place for currency, It turns out the ultimate currency ends up being gold. So, John, as we close, great advice. So if I was to sum up, higher gold prices, probably utilities in the short term, but you would be looking for a final capitulation in some of these strong sectors before you think we hit bottom.
That's pretty good, Jim, right there. You said it better than I did.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if people like to follow you, how could they do so, please?
So I'm at Wolf Research, and Wolf Research has a Twitter presence, and it's at Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, Daily Howell. And I'm at, my Twitter presence is at D-A, Chart Life.
All right. Well, John, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
You too, Jim. Always good to talk to you.
Contagion is jumping from the coronavirus to the financial markets, and Jim Rickards warns that we are seeing two complex systems crashing into one another as we speak. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners on FS Insider this week.
The model between epidemiology and financial contagion is more than a metaphor. The math is the same. The dynamics are the same. One has a lot to teach the other. Now, what we're seeing is multiple complex dynamic systems, namely the coronavirus, the economy, and capital markets crashing into another.
Jim Rickards is a best-selling author, international speaker, and former U.S. intelligence advisor. If you want to hear this full interview, in addition to our three interviews airing each week with investment strategists, book authors, and the leading economic forecast around the globe, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, stocks continue to decline with interest rates hitting record lows and a surprise rate cut coming from the Fed this week. Other central banks are cutting rates, and they are anticipating more to come. Where will this end? Joining us on the program is Danielle DiMartino-Booth. And Danielle, let's begin our discussion with the Fed surprise rate cut of a half a point this week. What do you think prompted that rather than waiting to, let's say, the March 17th meeting?
Well, the Fed has, unfortunately, it has inured markets. It has trained markets. It has conditioned investors to expect the Federal Reserve to do the market's bidding. And what that means is that anybody with a Bloomberg terminal can pull up a screen. They can type in WIRP, World Interest Rate Probability, go, and you can see exactly where the Fed is going to make its next move based on market pricing. Now, ever since Greenspan, so we're only talking about since 1987, but ever since Greenspan, the Fed has not defied market pricing. It has done what the market has asked for it to do. And so for Jay Powell at this fragile juncture in the economy to push back against the market would basically roll the dice on the credit markets. And that's a bet he's not willing to make.
The issue that I see here, in the past when the Fed did emergency rate cuts, it was a financial crisis. Think back to 2007, 2008. Danielle, this is more of a medical issue and a supply chain issue, which I'm not sure Fed rate hikes are going to have much of an impact on that.
Well, see, I'm going to push back a little bit. We've been writing extensively about this. The supply chain issue is going to be exacerbated by what's happening with the coronavirus. The best characterization I've heard thus far is that it's the trade war on steroids. So I'm not trying to downplay the effect that this is going to have on the supply chain, but that's irrelevant. In the sense of we are, China is, Europe is, service-driven. We're all service-driven economies. We have that as a commonality between us. The Chinese economy is 60.3% services in 2019. They've been trying to get to this point for a generation now, emulating the U.S. service-led economic model, and they've succeeded in doing that. And if you look at China, and if you start to look towards Europe, you're seeing the service sector get hurt much harder. And I'll just put this in context. In 2018, one in every 10 jobs worldwide was in the travel and tourism industry. And in the 5 years through the end of 2018, one in five jobs created in the world was in travel and tourism. So it is the hundreds of conferences that are getting canceled. It is China's largest export to the United States, which is travel. The second largest export to the United States is plane parts. So it is the service sector of the economy, the labor-intensive sector of the economy that is in the crosshairs of this corona. And that is what is problematic, is that it is going to hit our service sector harder than our manufacturing sector. We saw that last weekend out of China, that their service sector survey went down much more than their manufacturing sector survey. And we've got that coming to our shores because of the very sad response to the coronavirus on the part of our leadership. We can talk about the flu. I think this would be a good juncture to do that.
Yeah, I'd like to do that because I was reading a CDC report this morning. 32 million Americans have contacted the flu since the season began last September. Over 300,000 have been hospitalized. 18,000 have died. What makes the coronavirus different other than simply it's an unknown at this point? It seems to be a little bit more lethal. We don't have a vaccine. So let's put that in context of a normal flu season because nobody's talking about the 8,000 people that died last month.
Right. And I think that what's really problematic is that any national authority right now is going to be beholden to try and talk up the flu season. But if you look to one of the few places in the country where they have tests, you look to Seattle, eight of the fatalities had been ruled as flu deaths that were switched over subsequent to adequate proper testing to be the coronavirus. The problem is that in the same sense, in the same vein that in China and in Italy and in Taiwan is another example, you saw pneumonia deaths go way up before they had adequate testing as well. So because the United States doesn't have testing, there's a lot of people being identified as having the flu who are actually walking around with the coronavirus.
Let's talk about the impact then on the economy. You mentioned the service sector. We're seeing airlines are reporting people are canceling flights. Hotels are mentioning it's impacting them in Italy. The cafes have fewer tourists. How does this play out? Because we do know eventually as we get into warmer weather, typically the flu season ends. Is this just something that has to burn itself out before things turn around?
Well, we think so, but we're not sure. We're not completely out of the woods when it comes to weather because we have a cluster in Southern California. So again, this is such a new virus. Epidemiologists are racing against the clock to try and figure this out, but there's nothing that says for certain that it is weather driven. So I think the most important thing is trying to get Congress and the authorities in DC to get the tests out there, because if you speak to people in the industry, the most important thing at this juncture is to identify where the clusters are and cordon them off. And we're not there yet. So, but to your point about what's happening in Italy, Lufthansa, for example, the numbers are rising quickly in Germany, in Spain, in France. Lufthansa just announced 50% decrease in capacity out of Germany. Southwest Airlines here yesterday announced a very large hit that it's going to be absorbing to earnings because domestic travel is being canceled here in the United States. So look at this as the first domino in the service economy of the United States. And what follows this is hotel reservations being canceled, restaurants not being full. And these are some of the most labor-intensive, heavily employed sectors in the U.S. economy because you can't walk up to a kiosk and order a meal in a nice restaurant. It has to be, you have to interface with somebody. You have to have a bellboy ask if you need help with your luggage when you get to a hotel. These are labor-intensive industries, and that is why people are fading recent unemployment reports, because they're irrelevant in the context of what's to come for services.
It was amazing. I was reading a report by Goldman Sachs. They're saying that in the first quarter, GDP growth could be less than 1%. Zero in the second quarter, picking up at the end of the year. But to their forecast, they said, you know, quite honestly, these are just best guesses at this point because we really don't know.
It's true. I mean, we're really wandering in the dark right now. But you have to understand, it's so dangerous to draw parallels right now for one good reason. And that is where we are in the cycle. We have corporate debt at 74%, all non-financial credit in the United States at almost $16 trillion, 74% of GDP. Never in the history of the country have we seen a number this high. So it's not in the household sector this time. It's in the employing corporate sector that we're seeing the over-indebtedness. And that is why I think there's such skittishness in the market. That's why we're seeing such an overreaction in the bond market. It's because the credit markets that are one step removed from the rates market are in a very fragile position because of record levels of leverage. And that is not something that Jay Powell, by the way, with his toolbox, can even begin to address. And that is one of the reasons that he's running as scared as he is, with expectations that here in the next few months, we will get to the zero bound again.
Well, Larry Kudlow was on TV today, and he said that the administration is talking about targeted stimulus to industries that are impacted by this. That seemed to calm the market. Where do you see the Fed going from here? As we were speaking, the 10-year note got down to what, a little over 0.6% this morning. What do you see the Fed doing, and where do you see rates going?
Well, I think there's a presupposition in the market right now that we get to the zero bound and fairly quickly. We've got 50 basis points. We've got another half percentage point cut almost fully priced in for March the 18th. So I think that that's a given. The Federal Reserve goes into blackout Friday the 6th. So we won't be hearing anything from Fed officials until the 18th of March. So I think that that half percentage point cut is baked in. If you were to see some extraordinary headlines like the coronavirus has disappeared, then you might be able to say that the Federal Reserve would stop there. But if we see any similar type of trajectory once the test kits get available to the general public in large numbers, and we see the same trajectory once people start finally getting tested, they're like, oh, wait, that wasn't the flu. They've got the coronavirus. Let's move it from ledger A to ledger B. If you see the same type of charts that you've seen in China and subsequent to that in Asia and then in Iran and then in Europe, then the headlines are going to be such that the Fed goes to the zero bound probably by the April meeting.
So given that and the fact that, you know, we don't know exactly the details of this virus. I mean, they're scrambling to come up with a vaccine to analyze it. We don't know if it's airborne, is, you know, how you contact this. So this could play out well into summer, could it not?
In theory, it could. And I'm going to go back to where I started with this, and that is how very problematic it is that we're not testing for it. So the Chinese knew of the coronavirus in late November, and they needed to get the trade deal signed with an out clause because they knew the coronavirus was there. So they got the trade truce signed, knowing full well that they would not be able to honor it because they knew of the coronavirus. Then they let the news be released that the coronavirus was with us. But the catch is, how long millions of people who were infected were traveling around the world before restrictions came about. And so, it's going to be a matter of how quickly we can identify the clusters in the United States, cordon them off, and get this under control. And that's going to come down to the fiscal authorities. The Fed has absolutely nothing to do with this.
What do you think would happen if we actually went to quarantine and that made the headline news? Would that drive the market down further, in your opinion?
Oh, I couldn't see. I mean, quarantine is the kiss of death word. That is, it's why I'll give you a personal anecdote. I was in I'm in Texas, by the way, where there's three cases in Houston, Texas that are identified. So I'm where there is no panic. And yet I went to Sam's Club yesterday. They're already rationing how many bottled waters you can purchase. Stocked up on toilet paper because that's a hot commodity. My friends on the East Coast and the West Coast tell me there's not enough money to buy toilet paper right now. And I bought the very last bag of large bag of basmati rice, had to go to two different stores to get my hands on that. All I was trying to do is make sure that in the event of quarantine, I'm a mother of four children, will I have provisions in the house? But again, quarantine is a word you do not want to hear in the United States because we are a mobile, open, free country. that is used to being able to run out the door and get whatever we need whenever we want it.
Well, that's amazing. I was looking at emergency kits online, and several of the kits that were rated high sold out, sold out, sold out. 2 to 3 weeks delay. So apparently it's not just Costco or other places that the shelves are running empty on these items. It's spread around the country. So when we bring this down to investments, as an investor, what do you do here?
Well, you hope that because you knew, look, any investor who's been around for 20, 30 years knows how extraordinary these valuations have been. It's been a lot of fun to deny the valuations. And, you know, there's an entire cottage industry in the financial media that is in the business of denying valuations, but hopefully you were somewhat hedged. You were sitting on precious metals of some kind, .. just in case. And you were not 100% exposed just to the stock market. I mean, again, I'm doing a hindsight right now, but my point is, the market is still very close to its all-time highs. People are acting as if the world has ended, and yet the market is multiples of what it was in its past since 2009. We're still up triple. So you have to keep things in perspective, and if you're close to retirement, then maybe you should be considering looking at this as an opportunity to take a few chips off the table.
All right. Well, listen, Danielle, I know you're pretty busy, but if our listeners would like to follow your work, you have a newsletter, a lot of things that you publish. You're a prolific writer. How could they follow you?
The best way is to go to the website, Quill Intelligence, like you would think of an old-fashioned writing implement, quillintelligence.com. And you can certainly follow me on Twitter, @DeMartinoBooth.
All right. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome to this week's Smart Macro, where we're going to discuss the fundamental analysis and research that drives our investment strategy here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, as usual, with Chris Paplava, our Chief Investment Officer. So, Chris, this has been a wild couple weeks since we last spoke with you. Been a lot of major changes. Obviously, the market has been very volatile with the spread of the coronavirus outside of China to other countries. A lot of fear around how that's going to impact the U.S. and the U.S. consumer, of course, as well. What are your overall thoughts on the current situation as it is currently developing?
Well, the consensus going into the latter part of February was that this would be contained. Looking at some analysis done by Moody's, they were putting an 80% probability that this viral outbreak would be contained and only assigning a 20% probability that this would develop into a pandemic. And that's why I believe largely the financial markets ignored this through most of February. And that view was right. If you look at the number of countries that were reporting confirmed cases, it held very steady from late January through the latter part of February. We saw initial rise in January, and then that was leveling off around, somewhere around 25 to 28 countries that were having confirmed cases. And it remained flat. And so it did look like this could be potentially contained. And thanks to, and part of that was the aggressive response that China was taking to contain it, that it looked like we may be successful in seeing it contained to mostly China. In the latter part of February, we saw a huge jump in a continual rise in the number of countries displaying cases. And where the market really began to crack was 2 weekends ago when we heard about Italy, an outbreak over there. The outbreak in South Korea was growing, and we were seeing other areas that were starting to show outbreaks like Iran. And the thought that, okay, this is not contained evaporated very quickly. And that realization was causing everyone to reassess their forecasts. And we began to see a pretty significant market sell-off in the latter part of February and culminating into, you know, just over a 15% pullback by last Friday's low. And so, in my opinion, I think that's really kind of why this took so many people by surprise, was that the consensus widely held was that it was contained, and everyone was largely ignoring it until it was very clear that it wasn't.
Given that that's the case, and you know, there's a lot of talk that we've been having on FS Insider and obviously in the financial news media about the disruption to global supply chains, not just with China being offline for such a long time, but also other countries that are really important in shipping components and all the intermediate goods that are put into the finished goods that we all buy and use. So there's a lot of concerns over that. How are you viewing this situation, and particularly from the standpoint as someone who's investing clients' money in portfolios? You know, I mean, obviously you're having to decide, you know, if whether or not you're going to be wanting to raise cash, buy gold, and get more defensive, which is something that we have been doing for sure over the past few weeks. But give us an idea, how are you wrapping your head around this situation since it is so volatile?
So going into this week, I was trying to take a step back and think of how best to assess this. This truly is a black swan event. It's something that no one could predict. It literally came out of left field. And so I was trying to think of other examples of this and where there's a rapid onset that begins to impact financial markets and economies all over the world. And to me, I was thinking of geopolitical events that seemingly come out of nowhere, or even often at times commodity shocks where you have a rapid increase in commodity prices that put a strain on profit margins, consumers' pocketbooks, that could lead to a pullback. And so I did some work in kind of looking at some of these events, how it impacted the markets, how long it lasted, whether it led to recession or not, to kind of get at least a baseline of how to properly assess this. And I wanted to kind of go through some of the examples that I took a look at. The first one, you know, going back to at least, you know, in the post-World War II era, was the 61-62 Cuban Missile Crisis. That was a very stressful time that was, for most people, out of left field. And we did not see a recession in the U.S., so we didn't really see that a big hit to the economy. However, there was clearly a big hit to the financial markets who were reassessing the risk of a potential escalation in war. And over 7 months, the S&P fell roughly 28% over that time frame before things began to subside. The next example that I took a look at was the 1973 OPEC oil embargo. And in that case, oil jumped from just under $3 a barrel to nearly $12 a barrel in a short time, which did lead to a recession. And we saw the S&P fall 48% because of how severe that recession was. Now, of all the cases I looked at, that would be the most extreme, and I don't think we're going to do anything even close to that. The next example was the 1980 oil spike. Again, we saw oil jump nearly 100% from the prior year. That was a huge cost shock to economy and also to consumers. That did lead to a six-month recession, not a prolonged one, and we saw the S&P fall 27% in 2 months. It was a very rapid bear market, and then we saw inflation and oil prices subside, and that began the relief. The next one we saw was the 87 oil spike and market crash. A lot of people are aware that the market crashed in October of 1987, but not many people understand kind of the fundamental and economic backdrop prior to that. And again, oil does get blamed for a lot of things, and I think it had a significant impact to the 87 crash. And the reason why I say that was that oil prices jumped 92% from the prior year by July of 1987. The huge jump in oil prices led to higher inflation, and it caused the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates to cool inflation. And the sharp rise in interest rates and inflation, I believe, kind of helped to pop the stock bubble, or a huge push in the stock market, where the S&P fell 34% over a three-month time frame. No recession ensued from that. We also saw the 1990 oil spike. We saw oil prices jump 97% over the prior year. That led to an 8-month recession, and the S&P fell 20% in 3 months. And lastly, I looked at the 2000 oil shock. We saw oil prices jump nearly 150% from the prior year by February of 2000. And within the next year, the S&P fell 27% over the next year. So excluding the 1973 OPEC oil embargo shock, where we had a very deep recession, I don't think that's going to happen. The average decline in the S&P was 27%. So these were from short-lived shocks to the economy, short-lived shocks to the market, and that's roughly about what we saw is a, you know, a 20 to 27% decline. Now, when we look at what the S&P has done so far, the U.S. markets fell roughly 15% from the highs in 1 week, and we started to see a relief rally this week. Now, in my opinion, I think this relief rally, which was short-lived, in only a few days before we started to roll over, I don't think it's going to last.
What is it that you're specifically looking at that's causing you concern?
When the initial outbreak began in January, I started to graph the number of new cases each day and also the total number of cases. And viral outbreaks, they follow an exponential growth path, which means, one person infects 10 and then those 10 people begin to infect 10 more people each. So you can get a rapid growth in the number of cases when you have a viral outbreak. And so I began to track the number of cases in China, and it was following an exponential growth path where we're seeing a rapid increase in number of cases in China, even with their containment efforts. But roughly, I believe around mid-February into the latter part of February, we were seeing that the number of cases that we would have expected to see if it was continuing to follow an exponential path was beginning to break down from that, which was showing signs that, yes, China was beginning to contain the virus and that at least the worst was behind us in terms of the number of new cases appearing each day. Now, when I looked at the rest of the world cases, so the total number of cases excluding China, I began to do the same analysis where every day I'd put the number of cases in an Excel spreadsheet and I would create an exponential growth model. And that would allow me to project out where we should be. And what I'm looking for is exactly what I saw with China, is that the exponential growth of the number of cases outside of China would begin to decline or decelerate as it did in China. And unfortunately, we are not seeing that. One of the websites that I've been going to, I think is a great resource, is the Johns Hopkins coronavirus mapping page. And that's where I'm looking and getting the data from. And we are still seeing that the number of cases outside of China is still growing exponentially. And as of, I believe today, there's around 19,800 cases worldwide, excluding China. And to give you an idea of how rapid that growth can continue if we follow an exponential growth path, we're just under 20,000. And if we continue to follow an exponential model that I've created, it's projecting that we're going to be at 50,000 cases by March 13th. We will hit 100,000 cases 5 days later. So within 5 days, we're going to double from 50 to 100. And that's, again, how exponential growth can really lead to a huge jump and why we have a small number now that can really begin to balloon, where, you know, by the end of this month, we might have 500,000 cases worldwide unless we start seeing some huge containment in terms of the efforts by global countries.
So, Chris, given, as you said, we're seeing this exponential growth curve outside of China, and I think the markets are definitely pricing that in. But there's still a number of unknowns here. How are you assessing the economic impact specifically when we think about the impact of the global supply chain, potential effects on the U.S.? Is there a way that you have to assess some of these risks?
Since we don't really know how long this is going to continue and how long we're going to follow this exponential growth path, it is really hard to fully project and estimate what the economic impact will be and financial market impact will be. And for that reason, I think we have to, you know, take a very cautious wait and see approach. For China, you know, they're a big export powerhouse. And with this outbreak and containment efforts, the amount of production in China really dropped off precipitously. And that's led to a huge hit to their economy. For the U.S., the biggest concern in terms of commerce is, you know, will the consumer retrench? Will they stop going to movies? Will they stop going to sporting events? And, you know, given that the U.S. consumer is roughly 70% of the U.S. economy, you know, that is a primary concern for the U.S. And if we do go into a recession in the U.S., it's going to be consumer-led as consumers hold up with containment efforts and hold back on spending. That is the biggest risk to the U.S. economy. And we don't know yet fully the extent of this outbreak. We don't know if we can hold out until, you know, perhaps the late spring into early summer, where the number of cases may begin to die out like we typically see with the flu. That would be the best case. So, but we don't know from now until then how rapid this will spread and also what the response will be for consumers. And that's why I think it's best to take a wait and see approach. You know, instead of going in and buying the dip, you know, I would rather be late than early. And so if our approach is we did, you know, roughly about a month ago, begin to see some of our positions that were not keeping up with the market and breaking down. And we sold a few positions to raise some cash, particularly in energy. Even when the market rallying, energy was beginning to roll over. So we began to reduce our exposure there. And we, as you know, we've mentioned, Chris, on the show this year, we had an above average level to the stock market, given that we saw a pickup in global growth and we are expecting growth to continue. We have now gone from an overweight equities to neutral into slight underweight equities because we are in a defensive posture. And some of the things that are benefiting us at this point are, you know, having a cash position, having fixed income, and also having a gold position. And when we saw that this outbreak was beginning to occur and the dollar initially rallied, what we're seeing and what we believe we'll see is not unlike what we had in 08-09. There was a massive global response, both monetary and fiscal, to that economic downturn. And I think we're already starting to see that with the emergency 50 basis point cut by the Fed. The Bank of Canada cut 50 basis points, and there's lots of other central banks that are cutting. And I think we're going to see a lot of fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus to help get us out of this. And that, to me, will be highly reflationary and we'll likely to see gold prices move higher. The other thing that's supporting gold and why we've increased our allocation of gold for our clients is that when interest rates fall, real interest rates move into deeper negative territory, which has historically been bullish for gold. And so for us, you know, we do have a few hedges in the terms of having gold and having fixed income and having some cash, which is why it's really important to be diversified. You know, prior to this recent decline, there was a lot of euphoria. Everyone loves being in the stock market and taking on more risk than would be prudent when the market's going up. But risk and return go hand in hand. And that's clearly been seen over the last few weeks and why it's really important to know what your risk tolerance is and also to have a proper diversification of your accounts.
So it sounds like, as you said, all eyes are really on this exponential growth curve that we see of the number of infections outside of China. At this point, is it just the peak in the number of infection rates that you're going to be looking for? What is it that you're looking at to know, okay, the risk is behind us, it's time now to get back in the market?
One of the things that I look at to kind of help me understand the outcome bullish, is the outcome bearish? One of the things I use as a tool for me is to use a weight of the evidence approach. And essentially what I'm looking for is a harmony in various markets that are singing the same song. And that means I'm looking for equity markets, the credit markets, looking for currencies, commodities, that they're all moving in unison in the same direction. When they're not, someone has it wrong typically. And what I've been looking at this week, and also why I don't feel the worst is behind us yet and why we remain defensive and we're not aggressively buying this dip, is looking at the credit markets. I'm not seeing any relief yet. And when we've seen corrections in the past, like the fourth quarter of 2018 or the decline that we saw in 2015 with the devaluation of the Chinese currency, what I want to see is that if there's a true equity bottom and equity markets are rallying, I want to see the credit markets rally. And when I see that the credit markets are not budging, that tells me that the worst is likely not behind us, because I've found that the credit markets are less emotional. There's a lot less volatility there in terms of these big gyrations. It's usually they're going up consistently or they're going down consistently until they're not.
Chris, really quick, just for our audience, for those that may not be familiar with the credit markets, can you just explain exactly what that is?
Sure. You know, there's lots of ways to look at the credit markets. Credit markets being, you know, the debt market, whether it's corporate debt, that's government debt, emerging market debt. There's lots of, when I mean credit markets, I'm looking at, you know, debt markets, essentially. You know, most people are obviously aware of the equity market, the S&P, the Dow, but credit markets are looking at the other side of the equation, which is debt. And what I look for are a lot of different things. For example, to measure risk, one is spreads. For example, you know, what is the rate on a 10-year treasury? What is the rate on a 10-year corporate bond? And when there's risk being priced in the market demands a higher interest rate from corporations relative to risk-free rate treasuries to compensate them for more risk. So looking at the spread between interest rates, a risk-free asset and a risk asset can kind of help you assess the level of risk that's being priced in the market. And also there's insurance on the debt markets with credit default swaps. So investors will buy credit default swap insurance to protect them from default when there's times of stress. And so what I look for are, what are credit default swaps doing? Are they rising, which means that investors are perceiving a higher chance of default, or are they falling, which means that investors are starting to breathe a sigh of relief? And when I'm looking at credit default swaps on U.S. investment grade and high yield debt markets, I'm not seeing relief there. Credit default swaps are continuing to rise, and they're almost at levels that we saw at the 2018 lows in the fourth quarter. I'm also looking at certain pockets of the market that are, to me, kind of canaries in the coal mine. One would be the leveraged loan market, since there's been so much leverage this time, this cycle with buyouts of mergers and acquisitions. We saw the leveraged loan market really take a hit in the fourth quarter 2018, and it went straight down. It, you know, you didn't have this decline, a rally, and then a further decline. It just kept going down. And when we had the rally in October, November of 2018, we did not see that in the leveraged loan market. The leveraged loan market continued to suffer until the latter part of December, when we finally bottomed, and so did the market. When I'm looking at the present, since, you know, the peak that we saw last month, the leveraged loan market has not rallied yet. Even with the massive, I think we had the biggest rally in the Dow on Tuesday, where we, I think we rallied more than 1,200 points, the, you know, credit markets really didn't even flinch. And so that told me that that was probably going to be short-lived. Now, what I am watching is that we're really at highly elevated fear levels. The amount of fear that I'm seeing looking at, for example, options in the volatility market, looking at the VIX, the levels I'm seeing are, you know, we haven't seen this high of a fear in the market since October of 2008. Go back every decline that we've had, the 20% mini bear market of 2011, when the U.S. debt was downgraded, the near bear market in 2010, when we were worried about Greece defaulting on its debt and leaving the Eurozone. We've had a many number of scares, but what I'm seeing in the markets right now is fear on par with what, you know, we haven't seen these kind of levels since 2008. So there's concern about just, you know, blanketly selling everything right now. There could be a significant rally, like we saw earlier this week. There could be an announcement by governments putting some fiscal stimulus package to work, where the markets could be susceptible for volatility, both up and down. But what I'm looking for is I want to see some stabilization soon, because there are some areas of the market that are very key support levels. Looking at the Japanese yen to the dollar, it's at a very key support level that if it continues to strengthen, that could put further pressure on financial markets globally. If we see an unwind of the yen carry trade, oil prices are breaking down. That's going to put stress on U.S. energy companies here, as well as countries that export oil, other commodities like copper, iron ore. If we don't see the stabilization, these commodities could take a significant hit and obviously put more pressure on commodity exporting countries.
So in summary, we've seen a huge shift since we last spoke 2 weeks ago, obviously. A couple things that we're looking at that you have your eye on are the exponential growth curve of the number of infections as this coronavirus spreads worldwide. Also, the credit markets being a very clear indication of whether or not we've seen some stabilization in the financial markets. I think that is one reason why we can clearly say that the Fed came in with an intermarket meeting of a 50 basis point cut because of the deterioration that we've seen in the credit markets. That is a cause for concern, and one reason I believe you said that you think there could be some more downside in the markets if credit markets continue to deteriorate. I think we need to point that out. Outside of those two major things, the credit markets and this exponential growth curve and the number of infections needing to see that peak, what is the plan for clients at this point?
One message that I want to get out is that you know, whenever we have big declines like this, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And again, what I was mentioning earlier was there was a massive global coordinated response to the great financial crisis that we had in 08 and 09. That was monetary and fiscal stimulus. And we saw financial markets rally significantly over the next 12 to 2 years. And then we had some, you know, some pause there. But I think we're going to have the same. We're already seeing some stimulus come out monetarily. I think we're going to see some big fiscal stimulus packages where essentially that is going to create the growth that will be getting us out of this once we have a return to normalcy with this virus largely passing us. And that's what I do expect to see. I think we're going to see economic growth really accelerate. And not only accelerate, I think it's going to be a, what I think we'll see economically is probably very similar to what we saw from the financial markets last year. You know, when we had the huge decline in the S&P and we bottomed in December of 2018, we went straight up uninterrupted. It was a straight vertical climb persistently for months and months. I think we're going to see that economically. One of the things that I took a look at before this whole outbreak began was that global inventory were near 7-year lows. We are depleting stockpiles of key products, key components for manufacturing, that we're going to get even worse than that because of this outbreak, where we'll probably see inventory levels at levels not seen since the great financial crisis. So what does that mean? It means once this storm has passed, we are going to see a continuing humming of manufacturing plants all over the world to replenish reserves, to replenish inventories. And that, to me, will be a consistent growth acceleration in manufacturing output that will lead to a significant economic recovery on the other side of this. So that is the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't want everyone to get too bearish and, you know, head to their bunkers, because then when the bottom is in, you're going to miss an important opportunity to grab stocks with dividend yields that have exploded because of their price declines, or buy bonds that have taken a hit with now that have significant yields. So, you know, for us, we're seeing this as an opportunity to really help some of our clients who need income and they cannot survive on interest rates where they are. Well, you know, that's when we're going to see huge spikes in dividend yields, huge spikes in corporate bond yields. And so this is an opportunity. And I want to stress that this isn't a time to panic or head to the bunker, but, you know, stay defensive, which we are for our clients. We've got cash. We have our bonds and gold to help buffer this. But there will be significant opportunities to benefit on the way up out of this. And I think we'll see strong growth in the second half of the year and going into 2021.
Chris, that said, how can our listeners get a hold of you to discuss your outlook, any of the things that we discussed today, or to also take advantage of our investment services and some of the moves that we are making currently for clients?
They can call me at 888-486-3939, or they can send me an email at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
Chris, it was a pleasure having you on the show again. We look forward to speaking with you in another couple weeks.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.